you some thoughts that have been in my mind for 15 years or more. It began with a conversation with Tom Banks when we were having tea, and the question was, what about time when a big bang, when the universe began? And I said, I don't believe that time exists. I said, I believe that time began when the universe did. You know, the confronting of cancer, and it didn't be that way. Why do I think that? Well, simply, I didn't see how one can make a clock to define time. And then Tom took me by the scruff of the neck, drew me to a blackboard, and showed me some things. And I was very impressed, and for the next little while I worked on that problem. And I modified a little bit what he said. Well, more than a little bit. And I'll tell you the results of some of those things. But first, I think it's time to think about time classically. What did Mr. Newton say? And so first I shall give a little classical introduction to what I think about classical time. And from the lessons that we get about classical time, we'll go a little into cosmology and see how this might apply to how you define cosmological time. Well, Newton said this peculiar sentence at the beginning of a Principia, and I defy anybody to tell me what he was talking about. However, I would like to replace his sentence, his axiom, time is absolute, because simply I don't know what he was talking about, by something about which I can talk about, but my answer would be philosophically a little more disappointing than what Newton was trying to aim for, a deistic kind of thing, the fact of absolute, and replace it by a simpler question. That time is universal. What I mean by that is this. Well, first let us define time. I think everybody knows what time is all about. We just look at our watch. And then the duration of any process is determined by a correlation of points on a trajectory called the standard trajectory or a clock. And the configurations of matter are correlated to positions on this standard trajectory. Universality means that there can be many standard trajectories. I can be sitting in a train, and I can be drinking a cup of coffee, and I can use the needle of my watch as a standard. I can initially synchronize with the particular railroad tie and say that the angle of my watch corresponds to that railroad tie, and then if the train is moving at constant velocity, for example, I can simply count the number of railway ties which I cross and correlate them to the angle that my watch needle turns. A man on Jupiter can be looking at me with a telescope, and he can synchronize his watch to my watch, and his watch will turn, and they're all going to report the same value. The number of railroad ties I count, the number of the amount of angles my watch turns, the number of angles a man on Jupiter's watch turns, and so on. That's what I mean by universality. Well, if that is true, really, time is a pretty powerful concept, because it seems to be a parameter that's going to be useful for descriptions in a very general way, for descriptions of the physical processes in a general way. So we want to know why such a wonderful thing comes about. Why such a wonderful thing, and what the conditions are that this wonderful thing does come about. Well, the conditions are, as I mentioned, you have to synchronize these various timepieces together, which means that these various timepieces are not independent of one another, at least at some juncture in history or geography. These various timepieces are in interaction. So it's one single dynamical statistical system really for all these timepieces. The man on Jupiter has to look with his telescope. So there's an exchange of electromagnetism between us. I count the radio time. Everything is in a communication, at least for a little while. So it's one system, all of these things which are synchronized. One dynamical system. This single dynamical system also, clearly if these timepieces are going to be useful, has to be a completely isolated system. We don't want to consider, suppose I have the train and I have my watch and I have my cup of coffee. That's nice if it's an isolated system and I can use it either my watch or count the railroad ties and so on. If a cosmic ray comes in from the outside and it begins to hit my watch, well, my watch is useless. In order for the angles of my watch to be a useful timepiece along with the counting of the railroad ties, the two must be isolated. In other words, the energy of that system must be constant. A small detail, but useful, is that standard trajectories, which are inertial trajectories, are particularly useful. Because then the degree of freedom which changes that you watch will define a quantity, a dynamical quantity called time, which is simply proportional to the amount of change of that degree of freedom, a linear proportionality. And this makes inertial trajectories are very useful objects, and that's what we use with a watch that turns around at a regular rate. When you attach a piece of string to the end of the needle and draw it up, that's a one-to-one correspondence with an inertial trajectory. So that's why a watch is very useful. However, you need not. It's just a convenience. The convenience is fairly obvious from Mr. Newton's point of view. Newton said that momentum was conserved, and I guess he must have thought that the momentum must be conserved because he postulated once more this peculiar word, space is absolute. He meant that space is homogeneous and goes on forever, which was a wonderful idea at this time. And therefore, momentum was conserved. And inertial time is then of a great convenience to express what Newton thought were the correct equations. We now know that under some circumstances, what the approximations involved are. But let's stay with Newton and point out the advantage of inertial time. It says that this object, P, which would have been a constant in an inertial in a homogeneous universe, if you disturb the homogeneous character of the universe by putting a force source somewhere, the homogeneity is disturbed, the momentum is no longer constant, and we simply equate first order deviations from homogeneity, the amount of momentum which would have been conserved per unit length on the inertial trajectory, Tt, is equal to the change in another quantity which would have been constant had we conserved the homogeneity, but which is now allowed to vary in space, is simply equal to the derivative of that constant, of that quantity called the potential, per unit the distance along the length traversed by the system which is being examined. And this beautiful equation is simply the consequence of using inertial time. Namely, the inertial trajectory, the length on the inertial trajectory of time, to make this thing so simple. The universality, as I say, is more general. The standard can be accelerations. For example, the variations of the scale factor in cosmology is not an inertial trajectory. We will see later, as I keep on talking and doubling away, that nevertheless, we can use the scale factor of the universe in a good approximation as a clock. So we want to be quite general to understand the universality with a non-inertial trajectory. So let's be general. And we use the foundation, and this is an argument given to me by Manoj Parmitani. We want to I could.
So, in your conditions, you...
Oh, I asked you to be in front because of my deafness.
Are you demanding that it be monotonic or not for your universal, the conditions you have?
Everything's monotonic.
You don't mind, you demand it not stop or go backwards?
No, I haven't thought about things going backwards. Well, it comes to where, well...
Well, I guess when you put the scale factor...
The scale factor is another kettle of fish, yeah. Yes, I must ask people who ask me questions, ask them loudly. I bought batteries for my hearing aid before I left, and I probably lost them. Put that down to senility or whatever. So Renaud's argument was that we're going to synchronize. We're going to say that we have processes or trajectories, and that they, in a configuration, when the one dynamical system one has the value x10, then x2 is at x20. And system one has energy E1, and system two has energy E2. Then we can amuse ourselves and take derivatives of the action of these two systems and define two dynamical quantities. One involving system one and the other involving system two, and define these things, and here they are. Independent dynamical systems, dynamical quantities, nothing special. No reason why they should be equal. So why are they equal? What is the nature of the correlations that make them equal? Well, as I said, when we synchronize, there's communication. So they're interactions. So they're not independent systems. They're independent after we let them go. But it, technically and conceptually speaking, we have one dynamical system, one and two. If two was in a different universe, and there was never any communication between one and two, there would be never any relation between one and two. And there would be no sense of saying that these two times would be equal. So it's the initial synchronization, initial interaction, that forces us to consider that there's one and only one system, which is one plus two. Well, in that case, this principle of least action tells us that the action is minimum with respect to irrelevant quantities. We have to chuck our way one degree of freedom. They're not independent systems. They're all together one system and not two. And in particular, if we consider the energy split between one and two to be epsilon, and that's a redundant quantity, and the action must be minimal. In other words, we must ask the question, if x10 and x20 are the initial synchronization, and x1 and x2, and x1 is reached, I'll say then, for want of a better word, and x2, then, for what energy split epsilon does that happen? That when x1 hits x1 and x2 hits x2, that event happens simultaneously. For what energy split does that happen? And that's given by the principle of least action, namely the variational principle that the total action, S1 plus S2, is minimal with respect to the energy split. And therefore, the two times are equal. And that is the origin of the correlations that makes time universal. And then you can go on and on with other systems and make fancy and fancier systems. And then you can talk for hours. But I have one up. What's at the next slide? Yes, and you saw from the construction that there's nothing that constrains the club to be an inertial club. Because that's an accelerator. Now I want to make some subjective remarks. This is my opinion. I think we teach physics wrong. We plunk down Newton's laws, we use time, and we forget that we're men and women. We forget that a man came across time by looking at the star, by looking at the sun, and how the sun turned around the earth and so forth. A man didn't have abstract time. He looked at the heavens, or he looked, okay? And we should really go back to that. What we do is we go to the classroom and we write down Newton's laws. We use conservation law and we want to describe the Keplerian orbits. We use the conservation of angular momentum. And then the first book, line one, we interchange t and phi. We interchange the angle. We just get rid of t and we get r of phi, and that's the trajectory. It's the wrong way to do it. I don't know really what we should do, but I dislike that. I think that somehow, subjectively, I would prefer to teach physics in some kind of historical, epistemological context, which is closer to the history of mankind, my opinion. But the second point is, have we come closer to an epistemological appreciation of time? The daughter, who is a scholar of the classics, when I describe these things to her, tells me that the Janus is always portrayed, you know, if facing January to the future and December to the past, his hair always is sculpted from December to January. You know, his face is symmetrical, he looks backwards and forwards. His hair shows you the direction of time. And we have not, in this analysis, we've come nicely towards conceiving the measure of time and its universality, but really, philosophically, no, we've not come closer to, I feel, to the essence, if you like the word. It's philosophically not yet satisfying. However, when I was writing the seminar, the nice thought occurred to me, okay, I'm philosophically dissatisfied. Nevertheless, we live in a universe, and you can't make a stable universe without its moving. So the fact that I have to use motion to define time is perhaps not all that philosophically dissatisfying. Period.
Motion
is not energy. I have used energy.
Yeah, so which energy do you choose in the general
or
artistic
context? Yes. So I have used energy.
So what
energy
do you use?
In classical physics. So let's go to relativity.
Okay,
all right. So let's go to relativity. And anyway, I brought up cosmology in the subjective comment number two just for that reason, which it hooks up. The seminar continues then. So we're led naturally to consider cosmological time. Well, a nice way to introduce cosmology is through a poem. After all, it's very romantic, cosmology. More romantic you can't get in physics, I think. And this is a poem of T.S. Eliot, Brent Norton, the first of the four quartets, which in my opinion is the summit of 20th century poetry, at least in English literature. And the first verse of of Bernd Norton. Time present and time past are both perhaps present in time future, and time future contained in time past. If all time is eternally present, all time is unredeemable. Now, unredeemable is a little bit ambiguous in the mouth of T.S. Eliot. He was a religious man. I simply mean that we cannot ever contemplate in our experience involving all time. We just get a time slice. So that's pregnant with substance. It's amazing how poets express things and feel things, which I believe are, in this particular case, contain very deep truths. I'm going to work in mini superspace, and that's very bad, I hate it. However, I say it's not a bad thing to do after all, to start in a simple way, and then we can get transient thoughts here. This seminar will be limited to the simple case. It's about all I know how to do anyway. When I read Tom Banks' effort to get time from local gravity, I really couldn't follow very well. I didn't understand. Anyway, to prove what he did on a technical grounds in the first place. But I don't know much work that's done by getting out of mini superspace. I imagine one can when one fights with it. I haven't done it. So what I am going to show you is kind of an idealization, which I think, nevertheless, contains deep lessons and is worthwhile living with. And then we go further. So excuse the idealization and the oversimplification. Then the dynamics is concerned with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation couched in mini superspace, where the only degree of freedom is the scale factor. But do my hands get in the way when I should I? It's now getting to the point where I have to point to equations. The empty conversation stops. Is this supposed to? Is this? Well, I can't see. In addition to ears, there are bad eyes. I'm still doesn't help me. I'm sorry. Yeah, but that doesn't help me, it helps you. You know, don't grow old. Everything goes wrong. This, of course, is a very famous equation. It follows on very general grounds, which we want to keep probably always, no matter how general relativity is going to get modified and changed and become more specific. We do want physics to be invariant under a temporal reparametrization. We just had a talk with Lee Smolin doing the fanciest things imaginable, but that seems to be really always we stick to it. It's absolutely essential and it will remain. So it's a good thing. As I say, mini superspace is an idealization, but it already has such general things built into it. Now, what did our poet mean? Well, suppose the universe was a size array, suppose it was a usual quantum system, not a constraint system. Then we would say, well, the time-dependent Schrodinger equation would be valid. However, because of the constraint, this thing isn't valid. It's rather the DeWitt condition which is valid. It's psi is an integral over all time. How in heaven's name poets sense these things, God only knows. Of course I'm lying a little bit, because the time which I've introduced there is much more like a swing of this time than time. right? It's more like a path, more like a path parameter. Nevertheless, it's a good thing to realize that the Wheeler-DeWitt equation contains within it all the fact that all time is eternally present. But you can't redeem it, because the Wheeler-DeWitt equation is a constraint that tells us that if you have a field configuration at a given value of A, and if physics is going to work out well, then the psi function is going to be such that the correlations of the matter, the configuration phi, will be correlated against that A. By that I mean that for certain values of psi, there will be privileged other configurations phi at the A. If you change A to A plus delta A, then the wave function will be concentrated about another value of phi. And that's what we mean by the correlations of A and phi. If this works out to be the case, then A would be a good clock. Well, we assume that to be the case. For example, one of the things we use cosmology for is we can characterize configurations in the present universe by the if the temperature is well formed, we can characterize the universe by the value of the temperature T of A, and if T goes like 1 over A4, 1 over A, and that's a, that characterizes the particular configurations about which psi becomes maximum. So that's what we mean. Well, the first thing I did, so what else do I have to say? Oh, yeah. Well, the first line is what I just said. Well, let me not just keep on chattering. The first shot I had at it, after Tom Banks grabbed me by the scruff of the neck, this is what happened. My God, 15 years ago, even more, is I felt like a born Oppenheimer must have felt when quantum mechanics was born and they were describing the chemistry. And what did they do? They said, well, a molecule is composed of heavy nuclei about which it dances electrons. They said the nuclei are so heavy that they move ponderously slowly, so that the electrons have time to adjust adiabatically to their positions. And so we can solve parametrically by putting into the equation for the electrons slowly varying nuclear coordinates, and just watch how the wave function adapts to these ponderous degrees of freedom which move slowly, and then in the next approximation we can move the nuclei a bit faster, and that can induce the transitions from these adiabatic states. But in zero order approximation, that's the concept. And I then had the mistaken notion that because the Planck mass was so big, maybe that's what's going on, that I can correlate matter configurations to the universe because the Planck mass makes the gravitational degree of freedom ponderous, like the nuclei are ponderous. That's a wrong idea. I want to convince you that that's not the clue. The clue is not that the Planck mass is big, but that the universe is big. And I want to make this clear. And this will emerge in the next lines. For simplicity, so I'm going to follow one up. So the wave function is taken to be a product between a gravitational wave function and a matter wave function psi, which depends parametrically on A, the way the wave function of the electrons depends parametrically on the position of the nuclei. The Hamiltonian being the gravitational Hamiltonian of mini superspace, and the matter Hamiltonian, which it depends in general, parametrically on the day as well. For example, if you have conformal matter, the energies depend on one way on A. If you have more ponderous matter, it depends on another value of A and so forth. So you have to look through this parametric dependence, which I won't talk about much, but bear it in mind that you should do it. Well, if you contract it, and now I'm going to take the simplicity that the universe is closed, so it's normalizable. But that's just to converse. You don't have to do that. But it just makes a speaking about it easier. And so the first thing to do is to contract the way von Oppenheimer did against the matter wave function to find out how the gravitational part of the wave function varies due to the gravitational Hamiltonian. And this is what I meant, Lee. This is what I meant that you can buy cheaply, very cheap.
Excuse me?
What I did was cheap. I agree. But this ain't expensive. So, as von Oppenheimer, for molecules, the effective potential in which electrons move is not the interaction, is not the Hamiltonian of the nuclear part of the Hamiltonian. It's the Hamiltonian of the nuclear part of the Hamiltonian and a contribution to the potential which the electrons see, which the nuclei see, due to the fact that they're sitting in an electronic waveform. And that's absolutely essential. If you don't take that into account in the structure of a molecule, you get sheer and utter nonsense. You wouldn't get local minima, you wouldn't get stable molecules of anything. It's essential. And in gravity, it's essential. If I didn't have this, and the universe would be flat, HP would be the square of the Hubble constant, and this equation would be that the Hubble constant is zero. That's not the kind of cosmology we want. So, at the minimum, we should do some kind of thing like this to find an unequivocal cosmology. And I got rather a negative reaction in the beginning from this idea. I don't know how people now feel about it, but I take this to be really essential, that you must include the back reaction of matter onto the gravitational part of the wave function. It makes sense, a minimal amount of sense. So let's continue with this minimal amount of sense. It ain't much, huh? Because we know that the universe has fluctuating matter and we shouldn't be doing any superspace. We're taking precocious averages. But as I say, it has a great deal of a great number of conceptual lessons in it. And these then have to be elaborated upon to make it more realistic. Well, then I put this gravitational wave function back into the original Wheeler-DeWitt equation. I treat the gravitational wave function in a WKB approximation, so g to the I s effective, where s effective is the action due to the gravitational Hamiltonian plus the mean amount of energy. So it's the expanding universe that you get classically from the classical cosmological evolution that is encountered in the effective action of the gravity. WKB wave function is used. I'm not going to do all the algebra, but I think you can imagine. You take logs, etc. It's not transcendental. It's very interesting that the corrections to this simple equation, these are very interesting. And they are the fluctuations in the matter. Therefore, if the energy is distributed in a normal statistical way, which is generally what we assume. If we didn't assume that, we wouldn't have any right to be introducing any superspace in the first place. So if we take a macroscopic universe with usual statistical fluctuations, the corrections are one order of magnitude smaller than the terms which are retained. one order in the number of degrees of freedom in the visible universe. So that's not so bad. And now we use the Hamilton Jacobi system. As I said, you have a DS effective DA. DAS effective DA is the momentum of the gravity traveling in this effective potential by a ray. That's a dot. 12 constants are pretty equal to 1. And all relevant factors are pretty equal to 1. The important part, and this is thanks, this is really thanks to the solution, a dot d chi dA. So, d chi dA. Where T is the T that I spoke about in the classical physics section. So you recover the time dependent, something like the time dependent Schrodinger equation, where T is this universal time which I had introduced in the first part of the lecture. Notice that the left hand side isn't a Hamiltonian. That's wonderful. It tells you that when you learn elementary quantum mechanics, and you introduce the word stationary state, you shouldn't have said that a stationary state is psi of x times e to the iet. Here, stationary means stationary. If the system is in an energy eigenstate, d chi dt is zero. It's the liberty of that way. The word stationary is really well chosen. Time is a concept of non-stationarity. It comes from the, if you go back to one of my slides, I didn't emphasize it, I should have at that point. Psi is really a linear combination of components where the different components represent how the energy is split between the matter and the gravity. And what time really is an expression of the interference of these various energy components. And that's why here comes the difference between the energy component carried by chi and the mean value of the energy, which is assumed to be small because it's statistical. Nevertheless, because it's there, you do get evolution. So interference is the thing to capture the functions of the king. Now I want to go back to my friend and student Renaud, who is absolutely wonderful. I want to ask the question, how am I going to, what I've done until now is discussing in a vague way the global concepts. Now I'm going to be a little bit improved. I'm still going to be a mini superspace, which is bad, but we're going nevertheless to hold on to the idealization because we're going to get some information. Ask the question in a mini superspace, imagine somehow or other the system, that at a certain radius A0, an atom is excited, and that's what the probability is to find the atom unexcited at A. And I want to show that the answer is delivered by the quantum mechanical golden rule from all that we've said until now. So I wanted to write the golden rule. Well, now the Wheeler DeWitt equation is going to be written in preparation for going into an interaction representation. The matter is now an unperturbed Hamiltonian with an interaction. This might be, this will be, in now on, the energy of an atom in, say, an excited and ground state. This will be its interaction with the photons. With each interaction equal to zero, sign can be written in terms of a basis which are the unperturbed eigenfunctions of the matter. Here they are. And the four wave functions, then, are going to be built in such a way as to respect the Wheeler DeWitt constraint. So the basis functions, the four basis functions, are going to be the unperturbed wave functions, which are these things, and the gravitational wave function will be handled in the WKT approximation only with expansion. If there's an expansion and contraction, you know, you can die. Then you have to talk about whether there's going to be overlap between the contracting and contraction. It's a very hard problem. But that's what I'm not concerned with here. We want to know if the universe expands to what it says about time. So here is the unperturbed wave function with the eigenfunctions of H0, figuring here, with a WKB wave function whose energy is encoded in the gravitational action, where n here means that in the wave function, in the action of gravity, you include the energy matter, just as in the previous work we had proved the average energy of matter. Now it's the specific energy of matter, because matter is in the eigenfunction n, the energy eigenfunction n. So this is a modification of the gravitational actions due to the fact that we're in the energy eigenfunction n, and we're fixing the action in here to follow from the region of the wave. I call this term the recoil effect of on gravity from the fact that the matter is in a state. And it's this recoil effect of gravity. So the gravity is an operator value. The gravity wave function is now operator value, because it changes according to where the matter is. But when you plow that back into the Rita-Dirac equation, and you go into the analog of the interaction representation, so you treat H interaction, namely the interaction of the atom with the photon, with the photon field, and you end up with this equation. And that's just a straightforward substitution. You just imitate the same motions as you do in interaction representation in ordinary quantum mechanics. And the gravitational recoil functions are here. It's the exponential of the difference of phase. I've made some simplification, and that's, I guess I should dwell on that. The Wronskian normalization of the WKB wave function should be the square root of pi at n times the square root of pi at n prime. N might be in all the photons in the universe, so that's a tremendously big number. H is just inducing a difference in n due to the absorption or the emission of a few photons. So the difference of n and n prime is 1 out of 10 to the god knows how many. So I only keep the difference of n and n prime where it's sensitive, and where the difference in the net expression of n and n prime is going to be a negligible effect, like it will be in the normalization factor. And then I drop the difference in n and n prime, and I can take some value then between n and n prime, say between the 10 to the 100, or the plus or minus 1, that kind of thing. But here, 10 to the 100 plus 1 minus 10 to the 100 is 1. So that has to be kept, because that's everything. All the physics is here. You might say that it's crazy having a phase due to 10 to the 100 degrees of freedom. But you take the difference, and it's a difference in phase involving 1 degree of freedom, not 2 or 3. That's what comes in. So you put the pi in. Then you use the WKB setup. You grind the crank, you use the WKB wave function to eliminate the gravitational coordinate dA, and the gravitational energy E, and the gravitational momentum, to express things that we did in the very first slide, and write this in favor of dT. And what emerges? quantum mechanics. Now, there are various errors. Is the WKB wave function good? What are other kinds of errors? I neglect the pair production. As the universe expands, the only kinds of matrix elements are not those induced by the atomic transitions, but the production. These are small effects. So you have to make a list of small effects. I don't remember all that we did, but we worked a little bit, and we were convinced that this was okay in the context of mini superspace. For me, the worst, unrealistic part of this calculation is the precocious averaging that's been done. We're taking amplitudes based on average quantities instead of average amplitudes. We should really do an amplitude for the universe in a particular fluctuating state, and then take the average over that. That's a tough job, and that has not been done. So we've gotten some lessons, namely that time comes about in cosmology due to gravitational recoil, but we have not a realistic model, truly. However, we have gone a wee bit conceptually into understanding how time does come about in the general relativity in this way. So the lessons are that the Wheeler-DeWitt constraint delivers this adependent phase due to the gravitational recoil function. Using a Hamilton-Jacobi system, the phase difference of a gravitational action is equal to the energy difference times the usual time. And finally, we have Tom Banks' wonderful last sentence: time is a maquillage which encodes how gravity follows the transitions of matter. The constraint itself delivers the possibility of correlating different degrees of freedom, which would not have been correlated were it not for the constraint. And it's this correlation which is the time. It's not the t, it's a which is t. It's the scale factor which is t. Time has never gotten into it. Time has been introduced as a maquillage.
So you have identified time as the scale factor.
But that's what happened. That's what happened in the formalism. The formalism identified it. Yeah. And this concerns only the dynamics of the scale factor. And then, and this is a definition. Just like in the very first slide, T was a definition. I proved that the definition was useful because it was universal. And it's that universal T which comes up again here.
So, you talked a bit about how you go, if you go to beyond the mini superspace.
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
For instance, I guess that's an interesting situation. Here, sometimes there will be many scale factors.
Ah, yes. I'm assuming another homogeneity.
And then you will have to sum over there.
Yeah. And who knows, there might be a different time here and a different time here if the wave functions. We're not completely statistical out for the universe. If we didn't have inflation, and then we would have a fluctuating thing here and another fluctuating there. We rely on what we believe is true but in some measure untrue, but that it's sufficiently homogeneous of what we'd like to down makes sense. Otherwise, it would be different times.
But if I look at the equation.
Excuse me, now, the way it comes in, you see, is here.
Yeah,
these different times come in through here.
Yeah.
And because it's the pi, it's the momentum that delivers time. And if the momentum would be centered here about one value, one set of eigenfunctions, and here about another set, we would come upon the time.
So let's go back to the equation where you define the and dt is equal to pi e to the a.
Dt.
Yeah.
I'll write that again.
The equation where you define time.
I'm looking for it.
Yeah. So there are several variations of the
universe,
like A1, A2, whatever. Then these equations will
be equal to some. You mean the different parts of the universe?
No, it's just that now the wave function doesn't depend on one.
No longer in the mini superspace.
Yeah, you go beyond the superspace.
Yeah, it would be nice, wouldn't it?
Depends on any wave. I mean, one of the parallel situations is in the gravity, like, right? Then in general, there would not be one function, which is the sum of the
electricity. Yeah, momentum constraints and so on.
So which prevents the.
So you have to hope that at least there's a big enough patch so that some of this makes sense.
Okay.
I know what you mean.
I'm not in the right
one. You believe that I did the subplot? No,
yeah, that's where. Okay.
Yeah, because that's where it's no good.
I mean, that's why it's not clear whether this gets defined.
It's not clear. Yes, I agree. It's not clear that the idealization which I've used is okay. But how about temperature? We write T goes like 1 over 84, and that seems to be okay. What I'm doing here is that has a lot to do with the thermodynamics. And if the delta T fluctuates, if delta temperature doesn't fluctuate so much, that the concept of P of A is equal to 1 over 84 is a sensible statement. And then
the thermodynamics is a good analogy. But there is ability to be satisfied because there is this entropy. This is entropy tells you that you're going to be able to define temperature.
And here the entropy is a WKB phase.
Yeah.
Is that less good?
But it's okay. I mean, when you're
getting
okay.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know. Maybe you're.
But no. You don't have to dig your finger deep into the wound. What I said is that it's useful to get some concepts, by no means all. And you have a lot of. Now, who of Maryland, just before I left Washington last week, put his paper on the use of the mini superspace into my hand, which I haven't had time to read. But he says I should read it, and maybe I'll get some relief, and therefore I'll transfer that relief to you when I next see you. I hope so. I'm sorry, we just stuck there. And Lee one.
That was going to be my question.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Anybody answer that? Ask that question. You should ask that question. So you should grind me into the ground. All
right. Thank you.
It's clear? Clear? Have you heard this? Have you ever heard this?
No.
Leave me know, for you.
I mean,
So,
I hate the fucking.